One of the largest earthquakes recorded in the U.S. happened in the Midwest in 1811. How likely is another earthquake in the Midwest today? Plus, you might be on the hunt for news podcasts to listen to during your summer travels. We've got some recommendations for you during a summer podcast series we're doing all week. But first, cars and trucks recently surpassed coal as the number one source of emissions in Illinois. We'll talk about what led to this shift and what policies Illinois should put in place.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, if you live in the Midwest, earthquakes may not be on your mind, but 200 years ago, parts of our state experienced an earthquake of more than 7.5 magnitude. Plus, as more and more people are listening to podcasts, if you're planning to hit the road and need something good to listen to, we're going to give you some recommendations on some of the best news podcasts you might not have heard of. And we'd love to hear your recommendations. You can tweet us your favorite news podcasts at 21STShow. But first, last fall, the UN issued a report which said that the world needs to reach net zero in carbon emissions by 2050. If we don't, hundreds of millions more people will be at risk from the effects of climate change. Of course, the key to avoiding that warming is cutting emissions around the world, but the source of carbon emissions is a bit different in every community. And here in Illinois, the number one source has been coal for decades, actually, but now there's a new leader. That's exhaust from cars and trucks. Brett Chase reported on this from the Better Government Association, and he joins us now. Hi, Brett. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
On the line from Indianapolis, I also want to welcome Gabe Filippelli, a professor and director with the Center for Urban Health at IUPUI, and Brian Urbaszewski, the director of environmental health policy at the Respiratory Health Association. Gabe, Brian, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
So, Brett, I wonder if we can start with the years when coal was the biggest source of carbon emissions for Illinois. Is that all? I think people might think, oh, that's only coming from southern Illinois. Is that accurate?
There's quite a bit of coal downstate, but there are still plants up here. Waukegan, for instance, is a big plant. You know, we once had two plants right here in the city of Chicago, which were retired, I think it was 2012. But historically, you know, coal has been the largest source of carbon dioxide emissions until just recently. The 2016 is our most recent data, and car and truck emissions overtook it for the second time in decades.
And do we know why that's happening?
So you can look anecdotally at a number of things. I mean, I took a hard look at the data. There's a lot more miles being driven. It's interesting that the emissions are going up as we drive more fuel-efficient cars and the population is declining in Illinois. So you look at some of the trends. We still commute quite a bit. We're taking Uber and Lyft instead of public transportation, which is not good for the environment, and we also are ordering quite a bit of online deliveries. You're seeing more and more trucks deliver Amazon and other goods from online orders.
So, Brett, when we look at Illinois' emissions, how does that compare with other states right now?
For transportation emissions, I mean, we're bigger than all our bordering states. Just looking at our nearest neighbors, so we're the only ones that don't count. Coal is our biggest source. And I want to give a quick plug to the collaboration we did. This was part of a 14 Midwest Newsroom project that we did led by Inside Climate News. Each reporter did a local version of climate in their area.
And when we think about that, Gabe, I wonder what Brett started to mention, the rest of the Midwest, is when we look at Illinois, how do we compare to the rest of the Midwest when we're thinking about emissions? Everyone else around us is coal is still the number one source?
That's correct. We have our transportation emissions have followed a similar pattern to Illinois, interestingly. So they've nudged up a little bit. But whereas, I mean, part of the story is a good news story. Your electrical power production has plummeted in terms of contributions of greenhouse gases. Whereas Indiana simply has not. We have decreased somewhat from our peak, but to tell you the truth, coal is still the most dominant of all the sources by a good measure, even as a lot of the older coal-burning power plants are being retrofitted to natural gas.
But then when we're thinking about this sort of new emerging area of transportation emissions, how significant a problem is this, Gabe?
It's a huge problem. Brett indicated this. It's obviously a climate change problem. That's clear. But the emissions that come from the transportation industry have really strong health impacts. There's clear correlations of lost productivity and actually lost years of people living by major transportation corridors, just because a lot of these mobile sources, transportation sources, emit not only the gas CO2, but they emit particulate matter and other kinds of gases that are very, very difficult for people to handle. They actually, like I said, they cause lung and heart disease and take years off of life and even decrease IQ, believe it or not. So as long as we continue using both diesel and gasoline in our transportation systems, we'll continue having this problem, especially, as Brent indicated, in major cities.
This gave Filippelli with IUPUI Center for Urban Health. He was talking about respiratory health. Brian Urbaszewski is also with us with the Respiratory Health Association. Brian, how much are you all thinking about climate change affecting people's health in this country?
Well, like Gabe said, I mean, we're really concerned about it. We have an interesting way of getting to global warming and thinking about it. I mean, my organization has been around since 1906, and we've been working on air pollution issues consistently since the 1960s. And, you know, it's a pretty simple reason why. I mean, air pollutants are not good for your lungs. And we've really been focused on a couple big air pollutants that are sort of regional or urban air pollutants. It's ozone and particulate matter. And ozone's a caustic gas that essentially burns the inside of your lungs, and it's formed when sunshine cooks industrial emissions and transportation emissions. It kind of makes ozone as a byproduct. And particulate matter is just extremely fine particles, or what people think of as soot. It comes from things like coal plants and diesel engines. And so we focused on trying to reduce these because they make people sick, they send people to the hospital, and as Gabe mentioned, even worse. I mean, premature deaths are associated with high concentrations of these pollutants. So we focused on cleaning up and closing down big sources of pollution for these reasons. But in recent years, we found that accelerating climate change is actually making these problems worse. We're sort of on a treadmill. We're reducing some of the pollution that people are breathing, but climate change is actually driving it in the opposite direction. So with longer, hotter summers, you actually make more ozone. And with more climate extremes, like droughts and longer, hotter heat waves, you actually get more wildfires, which drives a lot more of the particulate matter, too. So as we've evolved over time and looked at, you know, the sources of air pollution, it winds up that the sources of greenhouse gases and these more immediate pollutants are basically the same.
That's Brian Urbaszewski with the Respiratory Health Association. We've been talking about this issue of emissions with Brett Chase, who's a reporter with the Better Government Association in Chicago. Brett, how much do we think, we're talking about the source of, just going back to the idea of vehicle emissions, how important are electric vehicles in this conversation as we're seeing a growing rise of those? And I'm thinking particularly of companies across Illinois that are really focused on that industry.
Yeah, I think that's the future, and local governments need to start looking at the reality of this being the vehicles that we're going to be driving, maybe not next year, but in the coming years. They're cleaner. We'll need an infrastructure. That's something that, you know, government needs to be thinking about. You know, how do we, are we fueling up at home, or are there going to be like electric vehicle gas stations and more charging stations? Local governments can, you know, set the example by replacing their diesel and gas fleets with electric vehicles.
Gabe, as you're thinking about what you're seeing happening out of Chicago, as you're thinking about the Midwest, I wonder how much you see Illinois shift as a sign of the future for other Midwestern states?
I really do. I mean, interesting thing is that, you know, even in Indiana, I mentioned that we're still a coal state, but we've gone from 95% coal for electrical power production to less than 50% in a relatively short amount of time because of a huge rise in renewables. Natural gas plays some role in that, so natural gas still is obviously a greenhouse gas. But the burning of it is much cleaner than coal. But I see this trend as actually a very positive one in terms of the electrical power production, but the transportation one is troubling. I was surprised when this report came out that we haven't chiseled away a little bit more. And, you know, it even calls, I think, more urgently for the development, as Brett mentioned, of switching over for rapid transit. For example, Indianapolis is just completing, and it will be done this summer, a rapid transit line. It's a bus-based one. It's all electric fleet. And so this is going to be a kind of a substantial step forward in the modeling of some of these solutions. But we need to share solutions across the Midwest. We've had a very similar history in terms of our power production and transportation, and we need to start sharing, continue to share great solutions and great ideas.
And I wonder, as we think about this, Brian, I think there are probably listeners who are wondering what they can do about climate change. This is often a conversation that seems very big for people, and they think, what can my individual choices matter? You know, some people do things like they don't eat meat or try to use less plastic, and I wonder how you think we should be thinking about this from transportation.
Well, it's like Brett said, it's kind of complicated. I mean, the reality is, you know, you want people to walk more, you want people to bike more, you want people to use more zero emission transportation sources. But the electrification of the transportation system is really going to be key. And I think transit is a good place to start. In fact, just touching on Chicago, one of the interesting things in Mayor Lightfoot's campaign platform was that she wants to completely transform the Chicago Transit Authority to run on 100% electric buses by 2030, which would be the same as what Los Angeles has indicated it's going to do. But there's other opportunities, and actually Chicago is making some progress towards that, but you even get downstate places like the Quad Cities also have electric buses already. So you're starting to see it trickle in already. Electric school buses are a new thing, advocating for that at the local level, making sure people know that that's an option now that should be being explored. And as investment decisions are being made, people should be asking for those. State and municipal fleets, too, you know, telling your elected officials that you want to see more of these non-polluting vehicles on the streets. And even at the state level, one of the interesting things that passed in the state capital budget was there's $70 million to build electric vehicle charging infrastructure in low-income areas. And there's also $80 million in a Volkswagen court settlement fund. Volkswagen cheated on their emissions or allegedly cheated on their emissions for diesel.
Well, the diesel thing, yeah.
But there's $80 million that Illinois still has that can be used to help electrify transportation, whether that's electric school buses or electric transit buses or building more charging infrastructure out there. There are resources available, and so asking your public officials when and where is that money going to be spent, how is it going to be spent, lets them know that people really care about these issues and want to see action quickly.
One last question for you, Brett. As Brian is talking about the big capital bill, I wonder, and we're also thinking about in Chicago, Mayor Lightfoot, her new administration, what do you see as the biggest hurdles to implementing these, political hurdles to implementing these policies in Illinois?
One place that the state has looked in recent years is switching to renewable energy, and there's still some legislation that might be dealt with later this year, but almost 3 years ago, we had a bailout of a couple of our nuclear plants, no bailout for coal, and also had incentives for renewable energy, solar and wind. Wind in particular is very popular in Illinois. You know, this has put the economic pressure on coal. So the coal plants are on their way out. I think you're really going to see a serious, you know, attempt to address the transportation issue. Now, we got a taste of the pushback from industry when Illinois Commerce Commission put out seemingly not controversial call for ideas on electric infrastructure. It really drew the ire of American Petroleum Institute, the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, the Koch brothers, their organization, the Americans for Prosperity. very vehement that there shouldn't be subsidies to help us make that transition to electric vehicles. But as I said before, I think that is going to be the future. So there will be the long-time interest, oil and gas. My money is probably, you know, on the electric vehicles and infrastructure in the long run.
That's Brett Chase reporting on thinking about transportation emissions, now leading the source of number one source of emission in Illinois. So we talk about the whole issue of climate change. As Brett said, this is part of a bunch of reporting that a group collaborated on. We will tweet it all out and have it at 21stshow.org. I want to thank Brett with the Better Government Association, Gabe Filippelli at IUPUI's Center for Urban Health, and Brian Urbaszewski with the Respiratory Health Association. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ella.
Coming up later this hour, the little-known history of earthquakes in the Midwest. More than 200 years ago, our region actually experienced one of the strongest earthquakes ever recorded in our country's history. But coming up next, summer officially starts this week, by the way. That's on Friday. Have you made your summer vacation plans yet? Well, if you plan a long drive or maybe a train ride to reduce carbon emissions, you might need something to listen to along the way. All this week, we are going to be sharing some of our favorite podcasts. Everything from light and fun conversations, shows that are meant for kids. After the break, we're going to talk about shows that help you better understand the news. And if you have a favorite podcast on any topic, you can tweet us all week. Our handle is 21stshow. You can always send us an email to tell us about your favorite podcast. That's talk@21stshow.org. You can text us. We have lots of ways for you to share your favorite podcast with us. If you want to text us, our number is 217-394-5765. If you save that in your phone, that's how you can text us. 217-394-5765. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning, and stay close. You're listening to The 21st. We'll start that conversation about podcasts just after this short break. Back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Keeping up with the news and current events can be daunting. We'll admit sometimes it's not the most scintillating thing, but if you're looking for podcasts to listen to on your next road trip, news shows may not be the first thing that come to mind, but there are lots of great shows that can keep you informed and are pretty entertaining at the same time. All this week, we're bringing you some of our favorite podcasts, and we wanted to start with those shows that can help inform you first. And we're starting today with Arm and a Leg. That's a show about the cost of healthcare from Dan Weissman. You may know him from his reporting on shows like Marketplace or Planet Money or Chicago's NPR station WBEZ. Dan is here to talk about a few of the surprising and frustrating healthcare stories featured on his podcast, but he also hopes that you also come away feeling both empowered and entertained by these stories. Season 2 of An Arm and a Leg just started. Dan's joining us from Chicago to tell us more about it. Hey, Dan, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, Nyla. Great to be here.
So, Dan, remind us why you wanted to do this podcast to start off with.
It just seemed like a big opportunity. It's a big story. It affects tons of people. And it is it's kind of an everything story, because these stories about people's health are super intimate. And it goes all the way up to the end. It can be super dramatic because it's also about our finances. It's about taking care of our families. And it goes all the way up to the top of our economy and our political process. So I'm like, yeah, count me in. This sounds like fun. And specifically, it's my story too, right? Like in my family, like my wife has her own business. And for a long time, I was like, well, I got to keep a regular job so we can have health insurance. And when I left a job and wasn't sure what the next job would be, I was like, crap, I'm limited by the things I want to do. You know, I have to think about, I may not be able to do, because who's going to give me health insurance to do them? So there's a little bit of a leap of faith involved in starting this show.
But now you're on season 2. It's worth it. And I'm curious, just first of all, how much the response you got from season 1 and from hearing from listeners informed what you did in season 2?
Hugely, hugely. We asked people during season one, like, hey, send us stories. And people had sent us so many stories. And I mean, the hardest part in some ways of the editorial process of season two was going through that enormous, fascinating, and sometimes really sad pile of stories and saying, well, which are the ones, that we're going to do first? Which are the ones we're going to, which ones can we take on right now? So our first three episodes are 100% drawn from stories that people sent us. And, the rest of the season, similarly, is the themes that we're exploring, even when we're talking to folks who didn't kind of get in touch with us as listeners. These are themes that we heard from people about. And, we were like, right on. Yeah, let's go pursue that.
And so was one of those people Liz? Was I don't know how you found Liz.
Liz saw me. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, she was a listener and got in touch. And she was like, oh, I got a story for you. And I was like, let me hear it. And it was a good story. Yeah. Where do we should we
Well, let's do this. So Liz, we have a bit of audio of Liz.
Yeah.
And so she had a medical bill she was facing for an MRI, right? And so Liz called these places that actually do MRIs that aren't affiliated with the hospital. And we wanted to play a little bit of her talking about her experience.
I leave the room, I put my clothes back on, I go out to the lobby, and then they said, "All right, here's your scans." I mean, they're literally handing them to me within that time it took me to put my clothes back on, my scans, and they handed me a bag with two chocolate chip cookies in it. I was like, "What? Like, and cookies?"
Okay, that's Liz, who from the Arm and Leg. She was one of the folks' stories featured in an Arm and a Leg podcast. They're in season two right now. Dan Weissman is the host and creator of it. He's on the line with us from Chicago as we're doing our. He's helping us kick off our summer podcast series. We're featuring lots of podcasts we like to introduce you to, maybe as you're doing your summer travels. So, Dan, I mean, that's kind of not how most people have an MRI, their experience when it's at a hospital, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, well, Liz, so the backstory here is Liz has been living with brain cancer for a decade, and she changed insurance, and she had been on a kind of HMO, which is, you pay them and then you see their doctors, and that's kind of you don't have big bills. And she got more traditional insurance. She went to a university hospital and ended up with a bill for $1,600 for an MRI, which, as she put it, is like it's like a week at Disneyland, including the flights and all the meals and the hotels. And so she went looking for a better deal and found one. But yeah, it's and one of the things that Liz points out is, yeah, a lot of people, like, when she was diagnosed, and a lot of people, if you may be in an emergency situation where the doctor's like, you're getting a brain scan right now, or you're getting an MRI right now, right here. So she had the resources and the time to plan ahead and call around.
But then not just the time, though, Dan, and this is a common theme in your podcast, is she also had sort of the ability and empowered herself to do that. And so much of your stories are about how much people have to take on while they're sick and kind of be innovative and take charge and handle things for themselves.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You got to watch your back all the time. And it's a burden. I mean, it sucks for all of us to have to deal with that and to kind of live in the fear of it. I mean, I think one of the things about Liz's story and about a lot of the stories we do is that I don't tend to focus on stories about people who are in a kind of health and financial disaster where everything's crashing down all at once. Because, I mean, we know those stories and we
There's
all live
lots
in
of reporting
fear
on
of
that
them.
too, with people
We
want to
live
read
in
that.
fear of them. Yeah. But all of us, I think, have the experience of, like, getting a bill and being like, this is a like, why is this so much? Like, what? And it financially, that kind of stuff really adds up over time. And I hope that one of the things people get from the show is like, yeah, okay, what can I do about that? Like, and there is limits sometimes to what we can do about it, for sure, and which also stinks. But yeah, it's one of my interests in doing the show is, like, how can I be more savvy, more prepared, less battered by this world where it's like, am I just being taken here? Like, what is the, like, do I have any recourse?
In the case of Liz, I wonder how much she found, and I wonder how much you picked her story because of the idea when you look at the landscape of American healthcare, there are like these private places now where you can go get an MRI. How much does that compete with a hospital? Will that change the system?
I mean, everything. I mean, one thing that someone said to me right away when I started looking at the show, working on the show, was like, there's no system. There's
It's
like,
just chaos.
it's just chaos. Yeah.
Yes.
And so, if you can kind of like latch onto something that helps you in this chaos, I'm like, great, do it. But will it change the system? Who the heck knows? I mean, I don't know. I don't
What
know.
are you? So, Dan, as you're thinking about this, as you think about finding these stories, healthcare, congratulations on season two.
Thank you.
What are you hoping that you have kind of created a community here for people to share information and talk? What are you hoping people take away from this?
Yeah, it's absolutely a goal, right? Is that like we're is to create, the experience that we're not alone with this, because it can feel very lonely. Like you get one of these bills and like, ugh, what do I do with it? And it's going to take a while, honestly, to figure out how to make that an active day-to-day reality. Like, how can we help each other out with this stuff? But absolutely, like a feeling, if nothing else, the experience of like, I'm not alone with this. And yeah, that's the that that's number one.
Can you give us a little preview of episodes that haven't come out yet?
This, well, so the clip we just heard, Liz Salmi's story, is featured in the episode that's coming out this week. It's part of really a trio of stories about how much things cost, because Liz had the experience of, her $1,600 bill was her share of an MRI that was charged to insurance at $10,000, which is insane.
Yeah.
And then where she gets the cookies, they're asking her for $87. So that's pretty different.
And you
And I
get
heard,
cookies
and you get cookies.
after your MRI.
Fast
This
service.
is it's really so. If you're interested more in this is there's all of these stories. They're fascinating. They're an arm and a leg. Dan Weissman is the host and creator of it. He's on the line with us from Chicago, where he does this national podcast that's now in its second season, out now. Hey, Dan, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Nyla, thanks so much for having me.
So healthcare, of course, is one of those many important issues in the news. As Dan mentioned, it can sometimes be overwhelming and a little depressing. You might say that as well about our national news cycle, but there are lots of great podcasts that help you understand what's going on, not just in Washington but around the world. And thankfully, they don't take themselves too seriously, even if the topics are. And a great example of that is from the news website Vox, and it's called Today Explained. Sham Rajaram is the host of Today Explained. He's on the line with us now. Hey, Sean, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey, so before we get to the show, I didn't realize until this morning you're from Toronto, so I feel like I have to say congratulations on the NBA championship. Are you still riding that?
Yeah, I'm streaming the parade while we talk.
Okay, great. So I think many of our listeners are familiar with Vox, but some might not be. So can you explain a little bit first about Vox and why the show is called Today Explained?
Yeah, Vox likes to explain the news. I mean, you can like read a news story, but full understanding comes, I think, from asking some deeper questions and digging into a little more background, and we do that every day on the program. We kind of took the Vox ethos and applied it to podcasting, and we do all sorts of different things every day. We don't just do the White House. We did an episode on zoning on Friday. We're working on an episode about Sudan today. We did the Hong Kong protest last week. We did Guatemala's election, the Central American migration crisis. We did something about
One of my favorite
magic
recent ones you
mushrooms.
did was milkshakes and Brexit and the milkshake protests that are happening with folks. So you mentioned zoning, Sean. Actually, we have a little bit of audio from the episode that came out on Friday, and the title of it is called Little Pink Houses for Nobody. Let's hear a little bit of it.
All right, guys, we got to talk about zoning. Not because we want to, but because we have to. You are now entering the zoning zone on Today Explained.
So, name. Zoning. Zoning. So, name.
We wanted to play that whole music clip for you there. Sean Ramasvaram is with us. He's the host of Today Explained. Sean, what is the deal with that song?
We just wanted to set the tone for the episode, and I don't think it's easy to sell an episode about zoning necessarily. I think a lot of
That
people
is
might
true.
be like, "What? Why are we doing this? Why are you talking about zoning?" So I wanted to get you jazzed about it. And, that sounds kind of, easily dismissed and sort of silly at the outset. But then we almost immediately after that portion you played get into some real hard data about the housing crisis in California over the fun music. And then, it's out. And then we have a serious episode about that, I think that was just to set the stage and set the mood. And then you're kind of like geared into the conversation, and it continues from there, and it goes in, in a sort of more traditional path for our show. But,
right.
I think our whole thing is, the news doesn't have to sound super flat and boring, and we're going to make it sound as interesting and fun and dynamic as we can every day, and we work really hard to that end.
And so let's talk about that episode a little bit more. Why did you guys feel like it was important to, first you talked about zoning, there was some really interesting history there, but then you really zoomed in on single family zoning.
Yeah, so the single family zoning is currently being blamed by lots of coastal cities for housing crises in California, up and down the coast, on the West Coast and the East Coast, as well as and then in the second half of the show, we go to Minneapolis, a city that has actually banned single-family zoning. So I think it's sort of controversial and contentious whether single-family zoning is purely to blame, but a lot of people attribute a lack of affordable housing, especially for minority communities, to single-family zoning, which, just to explain, is like housing regulations that dictate that, you can't have basically apartment buildings or multi-family, multi-resident units in certain parts of cities. And in California, this accounts for large swaths of popular areas. And some people say that it sort of was put in place to continue redlining and these sort of ugly traditions of racial housing discrimination, and Minneapolis went as far to get rid of it. So in the second half of our episode from Friday, which is this episode about single-family zoning mostly, I talked to the president of the Minneapolis City Council, who sort of breaks down how exactly they went about banning this and why exactly they went about banning it.
Mm-hmm. And so as we mentioned, you guys, the whole idea is to take 20 minutes or so to explain an issue. This can cover any array of things that are political or otherwise. And I'm thinking in particular of, I mentioned that Brexit one. What about, this was a really fun episode because it was kind of a bizarre instance. Were there four different situations of milkshakes being thrown on different members of British politicians and people protesting Brexit?
Yeah, I think we touched on four instances of milkshakes being thrown. I mean, yeah, that was an episode where we got into a serious conversation about Brexit and the European political status right now as far as Brexit's concerned, and as well as the EU Parliament. But we used this sort of new form of protest to get into it, which we were seeing a lot of in the past 2 weeks, which was British politicians, right-leaning politicians, some would say far-right politicians, getting milkshakes chucked at them, which, I don't think we make light of it, but we do have a, sort of comprehensive and serious conversation about why this new form of political protest came to pass and what it meant for British politics.
So, Sean, you're based in Washington, and I wonder how you handle the news cycle of things coming out of Washington and how you balance that with producing this on a daily basis and having not just news out of Washington, but for the rest of the world. How do you guys decide what you're going to do?
Well, we're a team of people. We're, I think, like currently seven and two interns, too. Shouts to the interns. And we, we have like long and serious conversations every day about what we should be covering. And I think there's a fair mix of what goes into our decision making. It's, have we covered it before? How have we covered it before? Is this really important news, or is this just something sort of superficial that the president's tweeting about? Is the president trying to get people to talk about this? What does he not want us talking about right now? There's, can we do something really interesting with this? Do we have a great person to explain it? Do we have a great guest on it? And so there's a whole mix of decision making that goes on to programming this show. But I think anyone on the team would say that we're really proud of what we cover and when we cover it and why we cover it. I think that's something that's really important to us. We really sort of cherish that responsibility.
That's Today Explained. Sean Ramos-Furum is the host of it. You can check it out wherever you get your podcast. Sean, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Residents near Cleveland were probably surprised last Monday when a 4.2 magnitude earthquake rattled northeast Ohio, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. An earthquake of that magnitude is noticeable but doesn't cause much damage, but it is a good reminder that earthquakes do happen in the Midwest. In fact, geologists point out that very large, damaging earthquakes have occurred in the Midwest in the past and are expected again. In 1811 and 1812, there were a series of earthquakes in the middle of the country known as the New Madrid earthquake, some of the largest in American history. And they were so strong that for a short time, they even changed the direction that the Mississippi River was flowing in. Joining us on the show today to talk about this is Conevery Valentius, a history professor at Boston College, where she's on the line from, who wrote a book about the New Madrid quakes. Also with us in studio to talk about what might be going on under our feet here in Illinois and the risk of earthquakes in our region is Tim Larson, a senior geophysicist with the Illinois State Geological Survey. Conevery, Tim, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
So, Conevery, when we think of earthquakes, I think everyone does tend to think of the West Coast, right? And I mean, we think of California, or we think of maybe earthquakes that happen in Asia or South America. In your book, you write about the New Madrid quakes. Can you remind us where these quakes happened?
So, you know, as if tornadoes and floods weren't enough, right? The Midwest also has to deal with earthquakes. These took place around the what we now call the Missouri Boot Heel, and they were epicentered there, but affected a really large swath of the country. And for reasons that geologists like Tim know way better than I do, earthquake movement travels a lot better in the mid-continent than it does out on the West Coast. So people actually felt the shocks of the New Madrid quakes, even though they were right along the middle Mississippi River. They felt them way out east and way up north of where they were, of where the epicenters were.
And can you paint a picture for us what these earthquakes were like in terms of how much damage they caused and those sorts of things?
So in modern terms, you know, we might look at the magnitude, and there's a lot of debate about the magnitude, but most people with expert opinions think they're, you know, in the low sevens, like maybe 7.3 to 7.5 moment magnitude. And in a lot of parts of the world, that would be a respectable quake, even a large quake, but not a devastating one. But these were happening in areas of really fertile floodplain, as y'all's reader, you know, as your listeners would know, really soft, what scientists call unconsolidated soil. And it would shake, and in fact, it would shake in the really disturbing term that kept coming up when I was interviewing scientists was like a bowl full of jelly. So what would happen was really cataclysmic for the people who felt them. Huge fissures opened in the earth called earthquake cracks. Large forests were actually snapped off mid-trunk. Really big trees got snapped over. The huge sand blows boiled up, and these were these things that kind of looked like small volcanoes. I mean, they weren't volcanoes in our...
Did you say sand blows?
Yeah. So these were like, you know, water under the surface put under great pressure, and it would spout up, making enormous piles of hot, wet sand.
Wow. How did you find out?
You can imagine.
And where did you get the details for this in your book? Because there are so many details of everything that happened.
So what's fascinating to me was that I grew up near that area in Arkansas, not far from where y'all's listeners are, and I didn't know anything about this. And I first started reading this as a historian of the 19th century in actually an account by Davy Crockett. And I thought, this guy knows what's going on. Why is he making up tall tales about earthquakes? So I started reading about them, and they were all over the popular press of the early 19th century. These were a big deal, and they got widely reported, but then they got subsequently completely erased from our histories and from our scientific knowledge for a very long time.
That's Canavery Valencius, the author of The Lost History of the New Madrid Quakes. Tim Larson is in studio with me as well here in Urbana. He's a geophysicist. And Tim, so when we think about the New Madrid Fault that caused this, so this quake was more than 200 years ago, right? This was the winter of 1811, 1812. Is this still active? This is still an active fault line?
It is still active today. There is very small earthquakes, magnitude 2, 2.5, barely felt at all.
So you don't, do you feel that?
Those happen every day. Down there's very good instrumentation down in that area today, and there's daily earthquakes in the New Madrid Fault Zone. They're not hardly felt at all. As you come further north into Illinois, there's another fault zone we call the Wabash Valley Fault Zone. Some people say it's an extension of the New Madrid. We would say it's something different. And we have earthquakes there every several a year that are felt. We have magnitude 5 earthquakes there about every 20 years.
Okay.
Some people might even remember that one back in 2008 was the last time we had a magnitude 5.2 earthquake.
And that was felt as how far north was that felt?
It woke me up here in Urbana.
Okay.
And it was felt up in Chicago as well.
It was. Mm-hmm. So, Ray, Mike, can you give us just a quick geography lesson here of where this fault line is and where people should be most concerned when we think about where the epicenter might be or epicenters could be?
Well, the New Madrid Zone goes up to the very southern end of Illinois. Then there's a break, and then on the northeast, on the southeast part of Illinois, there's the Wabash River. In the Wabash River Valley, there's faults that go through there, and they have been, seem to be reactivated recently, and they have magnitude 5 earthquakes. There was one in 68, one in the 80s, 2008. There might have been some, even a long time ago, we have evidence of those sand blows, even in the Wabash Valley Zone from a long time ago. So that's what we have here in Illinois. There's actually more larger earthquakes in Illinois than there are in the New Madrid Zone today. Now, we do know that those New Madrid earthquakes happen every 500 to 1,000 years. So we still know there's large earthquakes that happen down there. But it's a very difficult thing for us in the science, because the small ones, the little tiny ones that happen down there, but the bigger, medium-sized ones are not.
Do we know why they happen every 500 to 1,000 years?
Now, there's another good question. Why are we having these big earthquakes in the middle of the continent? We know more about the mechanics of earthquakes around the edges of the continents, around the ring of fire, as you talked about, that goes all the way around, say, the Pacific coast. But why do we have them in the middle? And that is a very difficult question to understand because there's so few of them. It's hard to see where they are occurring. They seem to happen on areas that were once the edge of the continent and are now being reactivated depending upon the stresses of modern as the plates move across those areas today.
That's Tim Larson, who's a geophysicist with the Illinois State Geological Survey. We're also speaking with Canavery Valencius, a history professor at Boston College and author of The Lost History of the New Madrid Quakes. And when we think about that, Canavery, I wonder if we know if when those earthquakes happened, so this is 1811, 1812, did people have a sense that, was there any level of expectation that this was an earthquake zone? Were people prepared? Did they think this would happen?
A lot of people who felt it thought it was the end of the world. You know, a lot of the Americans and Europeans in the area saw flashing lights in the sky. They smelt sulfur from all the marsh gas coming up. The earth shook and hot water came from underground. And they were pretty clear on what was going on. They read their Bible. It took a while for these events to actually even be classed as an earthquake, for people to understand, like, oh, that's what made me feel sick at my stomach and made my cattle all run away. You know, and made this new swampland appear, that was actually what we would call an earthquake. And one of the real interesting things to see in the discussions of the New Madrid quakes is how early American science took place as a lot of different people discussed what had happened, how they could try to measure it or understand the extent of it, you know, where was it centered, who felt it, what did it do? And so looking at the earthquakes is a way to understand both people, how people understood things spiritually, and then how they came to terms with them scientifically.
And then, so how did these tales, I mean, these tales, like, these became, like, as you were, you mentioned Davy Crockett, like, did these things sort of be, these actual events become, like, tales and people didn't think they really happened?
Yes, and I think it's really a cautionary story for us today, because these events were widely recognized as having happened, and everybody understood about them in the early 19th century and didn't know why they'd happened, but know they'd taken place. And then because of these earthquakes, as well as, you know, a bunch of other stuff that's happening in the early 19th century, the folks who'd felt the quakes closest to the epicenters moved away, and a flood of other immigration really put in a new populations in the areas closest to the epicenters down in the southern part of Illinois and in what's now Missouri. Those folks didn't have a memory of these quakes as clearly. Then they also put in place a lot of other environmental uses of the land, like timbering and lumbering and creating a lot of swamp drainage and cotton cultivation that erased a lot of the original environmental evidence of the quakes. And then some really exciting science happened. Scientists in the 1880s were able to, for the first time, realize their dream of getting self-registering instruments, getting machines that would record and quantify what earthquakes were doing. And that was tremendously exciting and gave us a lot of our modern earthquake science today. It really gave birth to modern seismology. But that instrumental revolution of modern seismology also meant that accounts and stories that had been taken place in, published in newspapers with lots of exclamation points and lots of commentaries about how much the dogs barked, well, that wasn't real science anymore. You know, that became seen as part of a folk record, not real modern stuff. So in a way, the creation of our modern seismology gave us a whole lot of knowledge, but made some of the prior information seem much less valuable, at least for a while, until modern scientists have rediscovered that record.
So, Tim, you're nodding, and as the modern scientist in the room, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more. When we were looking at USGS maps, there is still a region of southern Illinois that's kind of bright pink and fuchsia. Does that tell us what our earthquake risk might be for that part of the state of Illinois?
The USGS seismic hazard maps in the eastern part of the U.S. are based more on where there's been earthquakes that
on
we
history.
Know of.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the historical earthquakes and the what we would call the instrumental earthquakes, as opposed to out west where you can see faults that's mapped based on the faults. You can't hardly see the faults around here anyway. Those are based on the effects that have been known from the past earthquakes. So the bright red that you see down there along the Boot Hill is from the New Madrid earthquakes.
And do you think we're prepared?
Now, that's a loaded question, Hila. Are we prepared?
Are we aware of it? Do you think people are aware of the possibility, which in my mind would be a big part of preparation, right?
Yes, I think people in the southern part of our state are much more prepared than they are further north. And we still have that same issue that we've been talking about of a transiency of people. 2008, it was an earthquake that woke me up, and I talked to people around here. Do you remember that? No, I don't. I wasn't here in 2008. Well, that's just barely 10, 11 years ago.
Right.
We still have that transiency, so we're still having the problem of people's memory, and that's what's most important, people remembering it.
And so if you want to remember a little bit more or learn a little bit more of the history, Canaveri Valencia's book is called The Lost History of the New Madrid Quakes. I want to thank her. She teaches history at Boston College for joining us from Boston. Tim Larson is a geophysicist with Illinois State Geological Survey. We have a lot more information about this. USGS has actually published a lot of things to the point of preparedness that we will tweet out and have links at our website. But guys, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. That's all the time we have for. But tomorrow on the 21st, when it comes to Pride Month, big box stores and brands are throwing in their support with rainbow merchandise. We're going to talk about profiting from Pride. on tomorrow's 21st. And if you have thoughts with on that, we'd always love to hear them. Head to 21stshow.org to show how you can contribute to us there. We're also going to continue our week-long series on podcasts. And if you've got suggestions for podcasts, again, go to 21stshow.org. That's how you can email us, find us on social media. All of those links are there. We are produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpasan and Jasper Davidoff are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. If you want to find past shows, we're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Just search for The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.